There's one thing that frightens me about the spiritual attitude of people today more than anything else. I think it must be the general lack of concern at the prospect of judgment. I've heard it said once, I must have heard it a dozen times from the sort of proverbial man in the street. If I go to hell, he says, there'll be a lot of others going with me. The implication being, presumably, that if God is going to damn anybody, it will only be a few extreme cases. The majority will get through all right. They have to. Well, all I can say is that I wish I could be as sure of that as some of these people are. Fact is, on those occasions when God has stepped into history to punish men for their sins in the past, that just wasn't the case at all. Take Noah's flood. 8 people saved out of the whole globe. Take the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. 3 people saved out of 2 entire cities. And the same general lesson is implicit in our study passage today in Ezekiel. Look at chapter 5, verse 12 that we were reading. A third of your people will die of the plague or perish by famine inside you. A third will fall by the sword outside your walls, and a third I will scatter to the winds and pursue with the drawn sword. So it seems, you see, when it comes to divine judgment, there is no safety in numbers. Perfectly possible to go to hell in a crowd, and hell's not made any more tolerable by their company. This word of judgment, then, which Ezekiel offers to us tonight, is a word which we can't afford to turn aside with glib clichés about we'll all go together. It's a solemn word, an unpalatable word, but a word that deserves very serious attention. Indeed, it was Ezekiel's task as the watchman of Israel to make the people give the sort of serious attention that this message demanded. We're going to look tonight at how he did that. 3 headings for you, if you take notes. The first is this, the horror of judgment. We're going to look at that first, because Ezekiel goes perhaps into more detail than any other prophet on that subject. Then the reason for judgment. Ezekiel's quite explicit about that too. Then finally, I want you to notice just a few little hints in these 3 generally very somber chapters. 3 little hints of the hope that lies beyond judgment. Let's look at the horror of judgment first. Back at the beginning of chapter 4, where we started our reading. Take a clay tablet, put it in front of you, draw the city of Jerusalem on it, then lay siege to it. Erect a siege works, build a ramp, take an iron pan, place it as an iron wall between you and the city. It will be under siege, and you shall besiege it. Some of you may know that there's been a little bit of controversy recently, both in this church and in certain circles outside it, about the legitimacy of drama as a tool in Christian preaching. I think there are 2 basic kinds of objection that are raised against it. The first is on theological grounds. The primacy of the word as God's means of revelation, the prohibition of images in the 10 commandments, all this renders the visual arts unsuitable in the context of worship and evangelism, so it's claimed. The other objection is more subjective, comes really from a background of cultural prejudice. Ever since Mrs. Worthington was counselled not to let her daughter go on the stage, respectable classes in this country have suspected the theatre of being a den of vice, sometimes with justification, perhaps. So by process of association, this has generated the idea that church and theatre are somehow morally incompatible. Well, far be it from me to try to anaesthetize tender consciences on this matter, but I'm bound to say that those who want to explore the use of drama for Christian purposes have got a most powerful biblical protagonist in this man Ezekiel, haven't they? We find him in these chapters, first of all, making a visual aid to serve as an improvised stage backcloth. In verse 1. Then we find him building various stage props by which to animate a kind of miniaturized battle that comes close to a puppetry. Then he engages in a kind of mime tableau, first playing the role of God in attacking the city, And then in this business of lying on his side in verse 4 and following, portraying the sufferings of the people under siege within the city. Then finally, in chapter 5, which we read in the early verses of that, we find Ezekiel performing this piece of slapstick street theatre that I suspect would have received rave reviews as a fringe event at the Edinburgh Festival. First of all, he shaves himself with his military sword, and then does all kinds of odd things with the resulting hair. Now, if Ezekiel were with us today, he might well be hailed as a pioneer of contemporary drama. His antics would certainly be bizarre enough to get him an Arts Council award. Now, whatever the dangers and limitations of drama as a preaching aid may be, and of course there are some, it seems to me Ezekiel must constitute a biblical precedent for it that has to be reckoned with. Why did the prophet employ these strange techniques? Why wouldn't simple preaching suffice in his case? For sure, these theatricals are not just gimmicks to attract an audience. There's more to it than that. They had a rationale. See what God says in verse 3. This will be a sign for the house of Israel. Why was it? Why was it necessary? Well, I think there are two factors one can perhaps cite. The first thing one has to remember was the general atmosphere of complacency among his audience. If you were here last week, you'll recall that we said then the historical situation in which Ezekiel's ministry began was one of a mixture of despair and hope. The fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. Judah had become a vassal state of Babylon, and the majority of the educated elite, including Ezekiel, had been removed from Jerusalem to camps within Babylonia. But in spite of that national humiliation, there was still a lot of hope among the people. They might have been in exile, but Jerusalem was still there, a well-populated city with a proud and independent tradition. Soon her political ill fortune must come to an end, they were saying. Soon the power of Babylon would be broken, as other imperial powers had been broken before. Soon Jerusalem would be restored to the glory she used to have, before these imperialists with their vast military resources engulfed her. And many of the prophets were actually supporting that kind of optimism. The worst is over for Jerusalem, they said. From now on, peace and prosperity is all that remains. For people in that situation, you see, it was terribly hard for them to imagine anything devastating happening to Jerusalem. They were being brainwashed in quite the opposite direction. It was almost literally inconceivable. There's a very real chance that a man who simply stood up, as Ezekiel might have done, and preached the destruction of Jerusalem, that he would be laughed at or ignored. The complacency among the people, and I think that's one factor to bear in mind. The other thing to bear in mind is the remoteness of their exilic situation. They were 500 miles away from Jerusalem, dwelling in comparative comfort and security. Well, it's true their national pride had been injured, but they didn't live in fear for their lives, these exiles. Some of them were in fact doing quite well, especially characters like Daniel, who'd been taken into imperial service down in Babylon. See, when you're in that kind of safe situation yourself, it's very hard to empathize with those whose situation is different. A parallel situation for us, I suppose, is Northern Ireland. How much do we really participate in the agony of what's going on over there, even though we're fully aware of it? And we've got newspapers and television reports to aid our sense of immediacy. You can be sure these exiles, no matter how genuine their concern for Jerusalem might have been, they must have found it very hard to really feel a part of what was going on over there. Even if Ezekiel could win their attention, be much more difficult for him to really produce in them the sort of emotional response to the drama of Jerusalem's plight. Now, both those factors, it seems to me, may help us to understand why God instructed Ezekiel in this situation to employ dramatic illustrations in his message. Well, the fact is, visual representation of any kind adds enormously to two things in any act of communication. It adds first to people's attentiveness, and it adds, secondly, to the emotional impact of what is said. Television has proved that. You You have a charitable appeal for earthquake victims. Nothing much happens. Very limited support. Till the TV company send a news report out and bring back live pictures of the disaster. Then the money starts rolling in. The message has got over powerfully, you see, reinforced by the support of this visual input. For the vast majority of us, imagination is a much less vivid thing than actual sight. That's why often we need visual props. For Ezekiel, it wasn't so. He'd received a gift from God to see what others could not see. Future events were impressed with compelling clarity on his inner mind's eye. Terrible events. Events that literally had to be seen to be believed. But the exiles couldn't see them. Nor in their complacent and remote situation were words alone likely to be successful in communicating the shock of them. There's only one thing to be done. Ezekiel himself would be a kind of human video link. Not only would he tell the Jews about the imminent disaster, he would show it to them. This will be a sign to them, said the Lord. Using his model fort and toy soldiers, he depicts the invincible military supremacy of the Babylonian army as it surrounds Jerusalem, sets up its siege works against the city. Lying immobilized on his side for days, feeding himself on this starvation ration, he portrays to his fellow exiles the physical austerities that the siege conditions would produce. See what we read in verse 16 of chapter 4. I will cut off the supply of food in Jerusalem. The people will eat rationed food in anxiety and drink rationed water in despair. For food and water will be scarce. They will be appalled at the sight of each other and will waste away because of their sin. Those of us who've seen pictures of emaciated bodies of undernourished children on Oxfam posters will be in no doubt about just how horrifying a spectacle Ezekiel must have become after these long days of self-imposed famine. But nor would the end of the siege mark the end of the suffering of Jerusalem. For after the famine would come the bloodshed, and Ezekiel has a little drama to put on for that too in chapter 5, verse 2. With his sword and cutting off his hair, he symbolizes the further decimation of Jerusalem's population as a result of the final military assault. And even those who escape that slaughter, he says, will not be free from fear, for they will be scattered amongst the hostile nations where the prospect of persecution would continually hang over them. See how he sums it up in verse 12. A third will die of the plague or perish by famine, a third will fall by the sword, and a third I will scatter to the wind. Here's a message of despair, a horrifying message. The carefully nurtured hope of the exilic community dashed to the ground by Ezekiel's dramatization of forthcoming disaster. And it was only by making his fellow exiles spectators of these events that Ezekiel could get across to them the reality of the horror of this judgment that was coming. Perhaps the application to those of us who are Christians may well be that we must not be indifferent to the effectiveness of the methods we use to communicate God's truth. Ezekiel could have just stood up and said it all, and it had no effect at all, no impact at all. Nobody would have taken any notice. He wasn't content to do that. God was not content for him to do that. The message had to get across. The effectiveness was a factor. See, preaching for all its distinctive power is not the only way in which it's possible to communicate to people. Indeed, in days like ours, an awful lot of people are immune to preaching. They feel remote from the church. They feel the message the church preaches is foreign to their ears. Yet these are people under judgment. These are people who desperately need to be warned of the wrath of God, just as these exiles do. Of course, we must be discerning and spiritual in the methods we use to communicate to the world, but we mustn't be hamstrung either, it seems to me, by theological nitpicking or cultural prejudice come to that. Ezekiel has something to teach us about getting a message across by perhaps eccentric and unusual means. Something a church which seems to think that standing up on Sunday with a notice outside the door saying the sermon this Sunday will be on the judgment is sufficient. task of the watchman is not only to blow the trumpet, it's to make sure people hear the blast. Well, that's the first thing, the horror of judgment. We must find ways of communicating to men today. That's what a dreadful thing it is to face the wrath of God. The second thing I want you to notice is the reason for judgment. Ezekiel leaves us in no doubt about this. Look at chapter 5, verse 5 and following. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. This is Jerusalem, which I have set in the center of the nations with countries round her. Yet in her wickedness she has rebelled against my laws and decrees more than the nations and countries around her. The reason for this judgment was that Jerusalem had failed to live up to the responsibility that went along with her privilege. There's an irony here, you see. We often think that judgment is something God intends to place upon the heathen and upon atheists and upon gross criminals, I suppose. Well, the fact is, what we have here is judgment on the visible church, on Jerusalem. God had given her unparalleled opportunities to be the envy of the world. Unimaginable blessing could have belonged to Jerusalem. It would have resulted if she had obeyed the law of Moses and inherited the promises in that law. But those blessings were forfeit. Far from being the envy of the world, she was going to become a warning example to them. Ezekiel piles adjective upon adjective to describe this reversal of destiny. Look at verses 14 and 15. I will make you a ruin and a reproach among the nations around you. You will be a reproach and a taunt and a warning and an object of horror to the nations around you when I inflict punishment on you. But you see, God demands more of those to whom he has given more. The fact that we are church members, we hear the exposition of the Bible week by week, well, it's a blessing, of course it is. But it implies also a responsibility. There is no privilege without responsibility. God expects more of us because we have these advantages. And if we fail to make use of those advantages to our spiritual good and to God's glory, then there will be no immunity from judgment for us because we are church members and hear the scriptures week by week. God will see to it that our judgment will be all the more severe, for we are Jerusalem. I want you to notice within the general pattern of moral declension amongst the people of God, the thing which particularly stuck in the throat of God was idolatry. Again and again he makes reference to it. In chapter 5, verse 9, he speaks of detestable idols. In verse 11, he speaks of vile images. And chapter 6, which we didn't read, is actually almost completely taken up with this issue of idolatry. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set your face against the mountains of Israel. Prophesy against them. O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Sovereign Lord. Now, of course, God wasn't literally angry with Israelite topography, mountains and hills and the like. The point was, these were high places where the idolatrous shrines were always situated. Shrines which God intended to discredit along with those who worshipped them in his judgment. Look at verses 4 and 6. Your altars will be demolished, your incest altars will be smashed, and I will slay your people in front of your idols. I will lay the dead bodies of the Israelites in front of their idols. I will scatter your bones around your altars. In a sense, this picture Ezekiel paints of widespread idolatry is a very sad one. For only 30 years before, King Josiah had exterminated all these paganizing influences in Judah, demolished these very altars that Ezekiel's speaking about. Now, clearly, though the national legislation went against idolatry, the people's hearts were still idolatrous, even if they went underground, as it were. Once the restraining hand of Josiah's law was relaxed, all these old practices seemed to have swept back, as if his reform had never taken place at all, a lesson perhaps to us on the inability of legislative reform to work spiritual revival. But Josiah's arm was replaced by the Lord's. He would smash the idols, and with more success than Josiah had, said Ezekiel. I suppose idolatry is a subject which seems rather irrelevant to many people in the 20th century. We have the idea, when we think of the word idolatry, of totem poles, I suppose, and fertility dances and the like. We think of idolatry, in other words, in terms of crude paganism. Oh, we say our society isn't idolatrous, it's secularized. It's the precise opposite. Like, you know, was it Auguste Comte, the sociologist, who saw civilization as a kind of evolution from primitive religion and idolatry to scientific humanism, where all that kind of rubbish was banished to the land of myth and fantasy. Well, they say that's what's happening. Society is becoming less religious. Very commonly said. I doubt very much whether it's true. Certainly belief in the supernatural is on the way in today. But that is not the same thing at all as saying that society has abandoned idolatry. Our sacred cows may be secular ones, but they're not the less revered for that. People still seek to worship things. Some people worship their homes. There are some characters, you know, who no sooner have they finished redecorating the last bedroom, start again on the downstairs living room. Their whole life is taken up with a constant round of doing things to their houses. It never stops. Some people, it's the family, the children. Everything is done for them. No sacrifice is too great to lay at the altar of parental care. For some, it's career. Yes, for many, many people today, work has become an idol. It absorbs their whole life. Nowhere is that made clearer than when the time comes for them to retire and they find themselves suddenly completely destitute. Then, of course, there's Sunday, the most boring day of the week, the day which the average man in the world looks forward to least of all. An idol, you see, is a sacred object in which man seeks to find the answer to his inner desire for fulfillment and personal identity. Those are what are gods, those are idols. We've got plenty, secular ones may be, but just as sacred. So Ezekiel's prophecy here is just as relevant to us as it was to Israel. Only instead of directing it against the mountains, Ezekiel would direct it, in our case probably, against our suburban sprawl and executive office blocks. But wherever idolatry comes, wherever it grips the hearts of men, there is a nation under judgment. A nation in a terminal situation. Look what he says in chapter 7, verse 2. Son of man, this is what the sovereign Lord says to the land of Israel. The end has come. Often the prophets had encouraged people in time past to look forward to a coming day of salvation and victory. That would be the end. Isaiah had spoken of the last days as a time when Zion would be the chief mountain in the whole world and all the nations would come up to worship at the shrine of Jehovah there. But here is Ezekiel speaking of a different kind of last day altogether. See what he says in verse 7? Doom has come upon you. The time has come. The day is near. There is panic, not joy, upon the mountain. Wherever he looks, Ezekiel sees the same story of forlorn hopelessness. Or rather amusingly, he picks up the businessman, looking a bit on the bright side, taking advantage of the depressed economic situation to make a quick bob or two in verse 12 of chapter 7, forcing people to liquidize their assets at low prices in order to buy food. But such gains, he says, will be very short-lived. The time has come, the day has arrived. Let not the buyer rejoice, nor the seller grieve. For wrath is upon the whole crowd. In other words, a bargain is nothing to be happy about, nor is an unfavorable sale anything to be sad about. For in this situation, this end, there are going to be no winners, only losers. Indeed, by the end of the siege, all the money in the city won't buy a square meal, says Ezekiel. Verse 19, they'll throw their silver into the streets and their gold will be an unclean thing. Their silver and gold will not be able to save them in the day of the Lord's wrath. The security forces? The army? Oh yes, well, they'll be mobilized, of course, but nobody will ever march. Verse 14. Though they blow the trumpet and get everything ready, no one will go into battle, for my wrath is upon the whole crowd. The politicians, oh, they'll try diplomacy, but that won't be very successful either. Verse 25, when terror comes, they'll seek peace, but there'll be none. They'll look for the guidance of the traditional advisers of the nation, the prophet, the priest, the elders. But none of them will have the answer, he says in verse 26. So the government will mourn, the prince will be clothed with despair, and the hands of the people of the land will tremble. It's the end, you see. Unlike the first Babylonian attack, this would be no blitzkrieg terminated by a kind of generous peace treaty. Now, what awaited Jerusalem this time was a long, agonizing holocaust, the end. Ezekiel offers an eschatology not of hope, but of despair. The end has come, he says. All because of the idolatry of the people. The thing I want you to notice most of all, though, in this section on the reasons for the judgment, the thing I want you to notice is the prominence that Ezekiel gives to the pronoun I. See in chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. I will unleash my anger against you. I will judge you according to your conduct and repay you for all your detestable practices. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. I will surely repay you for your conduct. Then you will know that I am the Lord. It was the personal anger, you see, of God that these people were discovering. God was going to exact retribution and exact it personally. Many people are offended about this. There are some theologians who want to make out that God's wrath is a kind of impersonal force built into the nature of things. There are some who want to say that the God of vengeance is a kind of primitive hangover from the pagan environment in which the Bible grew up. It's not really part of the biblical, the true character of God. But that just won't do. Ezekiel could not be more explicit. Look at verse 9, chapter 7. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. I will repay you in accordance with your conduct and the detestable practices among you. And then you will know that it is I, the Lord, who strikes the blow. A terrifying verse. To people, you see, who had grown up listening to all the comforting names of God. Jehovah Jireh, the Lord, the provider. Jehovah Nisai, the Lord, our banner. And countless other names like that. Names of comfort. It must have been a theological thunderbolt to be told that he was also called Jehovah Makeh, the Lord, the Smiter. But such is the truth. For this God of the Bible that we come to worship today is not some sentimental weakling. He is a God who is personally angry with those who worship anything other than him. He is a God who can be glorified even in judgment. Then they will know, I am the Lord. But that brings me to the last thing I want you to think about tonight. And that is the hope that lies beyond judgment. Look at verse 8 of chapter 6. But I will spare some. See that? One of the most difficult tasks for any preacher is to maintain the balance of truth. It's unfortunate, but it's possible to preach for a lifetime and never utter one untrue word and yet to cruelly deceive people. Take the Reverend Jones, for instance. Now, he's a warm gentleman, burning concern to see people know the comforts of religion. Every Sunday he preaches enthusiastically on John 3:16. God so loves the world, and he portrays with tears in his eyes the appeal of a heartbroken heavenly father holding open arms of love to his wayward children. God loves you, he says. And of course he's right. But somehow his exposition never gets down as far as John 3:36, which says, he who does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. He's so absolutely absorbed in the love of God, he misleads his congregation into underestimating the other side of God's character, his anger against moral rebellion. And the result is complacency. His people feel very secure, but too secure. Then there's the Reverend Smith, on the other hand. Not David, of course. He goes the opposite extreme. He's an austere and rigorous man, great preacher on holiness. Every Sunday he hangs his congregation over the pit of hell by a single thread and warns them of judgment to come. He likes to preach on Matthew 25:41, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels." Of course, what he's saying is very necessary. But once again, his stress is unbalanced. He never seems to get to that part of the gospel where Jesus says to the sinner woman, "Your sins are forgiven you." And consequently, his congregation develop an unhealthy anxiety about their relationship to God. They know enough about God to fear him and not enough to love him, which is a terrible thing. You see what I mean about unbalanced preaching, turning the truth of God into a lie. Somehow these faithful preachers manage not to communicate the truth. For the truth is a blending together of what Paul called the goodness and the severity of God. And the blend is not always 50-50. It depends on the spiritual condition of the congregation. The preacher is a doctor who must mix his prescription with an eye on the patient's illness. Complacency needs to be shaken out with a little godly fear. Insecurity needs to be comforted with a little gospel assurance. The Reverend Smith and the Reverend Jones ought to exchange pulpits from time to time. In fact, that would be a much better solution than you'd think. For one danger of recognizing this balance between love and wrath in God's character is that the preacher expounds a kind of insipid compromise between the two. That isn't right either. No, God is extremely angry. God is extremely loving. Both those propositions are true. And what the preacher must do is mix those two things together in the proportion that his congregation need at that particular stage in their spiritual history. And that's what we see Ezekiel doing here. 95% of this chapter, or these chapters we're reading, is all about judgment. Uncompromising judgment. Judgment that seems to leave no possibility of hope in it at all. The end, he says, the end. And yet just here and there, thrown in as it were, there's a little bit of the other side. The hope. I will spare some. It's there in that piece of histrionic he does with his sword and his hair. Did you notice he had to hide some of the hair away in the fold of his garment? Some were going to be safe, you see. It's also there in this strange number of days that he was told to lie on his side. I don't know if you noticed that. 390 days for the house of Israel, it says in chapter 4, and 40 days for the house of Judah. That's in verses 5 and 6. Scholars have done all kinds of calculations to try and make that correspond to some period in Israel's history. Does it correspond to the length of time between the fall of Samaria and the return from exile? Does it correspond in some way to the length of the exile? What exactly does these strange number of days or years represent? All kinds of suggestions have been made. None very convincing. For you see, I think these numbers are just symbolic. 390 days for Israel and 40 for Judah makes 430 altogether. And 430 years was the time, according to Exodus chapter 12, that Israel was in bondage in Egypt. What's more, 40 years was, of course, the time of the wandering in the wilderness. Ezekiel isn't trying to make some historical prediction in terms of dates here. He's using two symbolic numbers. For what God said would happen to the people if they abandoned him and worshipped idols was that he would send them back to Egypt. And that's what Ezekiel says is going to happen to them. Not the literal Egypt over there on the Nile. No, but in exile, their spiritual experience would be just what their forefathers had experienced in that time, in bondage in the land of Egypt. In a sense, of course, that was a pretty terrible thing to be told. And yet there's a very strong positive side to it, of course. Because at the end of the Egyptian bondage came the Exodus. At the end of the wilderness came the Promised Land. By setting these symbolic figures of 430 years and 40 years on his time of lying symbolically under siege, Ezekiel is saying, look, your punishment will be severe, but it won't be interminable. There will come an end to it. God's antagonism will not last forever. And what's more, it will not be without hope. See what he says in chapter 6 again? I will spare some, for some of you will escape the sword when you're scattered among the lands and nations. And then in the nations where they have been carried captive, those who escape will remember me, how I've been grieved by their adulterous hearts, which have turned away from me, and by their eyes, which have lusted after their idols. They will loathe themselves for the evil they have done and for all their detestable practices. And they will know that I am the Lord. I did not threaten in vain to bring this calamity on. So you see, a hint of hope. A few would survive, a remnant, refined and chastened by the horror of this judgment. Understanding the reasons for this judgment, they would be there to carry the purpose of God forward, hiding in the hem of Ezekiel's garden. Judgment is a terrifying thing. And yet there's a real sense, says Ezekiel, in which it's something to be glad about. That's the meaning of this verse 11 in chapter 6. This is what the Sovereign Lord said, strike your hands together and stamp your feet and cry out, not alas. That's a mistranslation. Because clapping your hands and stamping your feet were signs of joy. Cry out, hooray! Because of all the wicked and detestable practices of the house of Israel, for they will fall by the sword, famine, and plague. Seems a strange thing to say, but it isn't. It is a cause for thankfulness, Ezekiel says, that the idolatry of Israel will be purged out of them. Because hope can only emerge in the people of God out of the cauldron of the refiner's fire. And that, perhaps, is the lesson with which we ought to end. Judgment is horrifying. God is angry with sinners. And never more so than when it is his own people with whom he has entrusted his word, whom he intends to be a light to the Gentiles, his own people who so corrupt themselves that they become worse than the pagans to whom they're supposed to witness. Never is he more angry than that. But even if his anger blazes like a fire against his people in that situation, those who are truly his people, he won't abandon. In the midst of wrath, he remembers mercy. And that may be something for us personally and as a society to think about. Perhaps you feel in some way that you've been under the judgment. It's not impossible. God's people are often chastened. His judgments are often upon them. But it's not a judgment without hope. It may last a long while, but it will be like Egypt, like the wilderness for you. There's hope at the end of it. And maybe for us too as a church. I do seriously wonder sometimes if the church in this country hasn't in some sense been under the judgment of God. We've immersed ourselves so much in our own internal affairs, neglected so much the proclamation of the gospel, fought amongst ourselves so much. I do sometimes wonder whether the fact that the church has sunk so low isn't a reflection of our real failure to communicate the gospel as God intended us to the world around us. Well, it's not a judgment without hope, if so. The days of revival will come. The bones in the cemetery will rise again. But that's another sermon. Let's pray together.